Well, I would like to open up with a true story that has a happy ending. The names are changed here. My husband Mark and I are approaching the next year in our marriage with great delight and anticipation. In addition to the personal goals that we've set for ourselves, this year we're looking forward to adding to our family by having our first child. And after nearly 4 years of marriage, we're ready to leave the, quote, young married state and finally feel enough like a team, strongly connected to each other and to God, to take this adventuresome step. But this person went on to say that it wasn't always that way. Their marriage blossomed into a relationship that was absolutely wonderful. But as she said, it wasn't always on solid ground. Nearly 2 years ago, this person writes, I was sure my marriage had ended one sunny Sunday afternoon in June. For our two-year anniversary, my parents had given Mark and me a weekend stay at the beautiful Bed and Breakfast Inn on the coast of North Carolina. Mark and I hoped that the time away from the financial academic pressures of graduate school would bring an end to the constant bickering and daily shouting matches that had characterized our interaction for months. Unfortunately, while the getaway was a nice idea, what actually happened was a disaster. After arguing bitterly about spending money on cheaply made but expensively priced beach towels and chairs at the beach shop, we forgot our towels and chairs at home, we arrived at a place the locals call Dog Beach. To my horror, I realized that this spot was aptly named. We saw dogs, lots of dogs, more than 50, and their owners cavorting in the water. And instead of the pristine white sand described by our innkeeper on the phone, the beach consisted of sandbags piled up to prevent erosion. I'd had it. I was still furious with Mark for prevailing in our little discussion to buy that stupid beach gear. That couldn't have possibly been the real reason, the real issue. And he brought me to Dog Beach. I don't even like dogs. Why bother, I thought, as I turned back to walk to the car. Passing my husband on the way, I hissed at him. This is all your fault. This weekend is over. Halfway to the car, I ripped the straw sun hat off of my head and threw it to the ground. Allison, Mark screamed after me. Get back here and pick up that hat. Ignoring him, I walked away faster, head down, tears streaming from my cheeks. Mark later told me how my defiant refusal had made him blindingly angry. When en route to our inn, I cried quietly. This week is unsalvageable, I insisted. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Mark's jaw clench in frustration, but he said nothing. This marriage is over, I thought. We can't go on this way, feeling miserable and tearing each other to pieces. Then bitterly I said out loud what I was thinking. Our room. Once inside, he flopped down the bed, staring at the ceiling. What was he thinking? Why wouldn't he talk? Weeks later, he told me he lay there wondering what he would really do if I had given up. At that time, I wondered, who is this stranger that I thought was my husband? I felt like he was a million miles away. Going into the tiny bathroom, I turned on the shower as hot as I could bear it and sat in the tub under the stinging spray, crying. What seemed like hours later, Mark climbed into the tub with me, put his arm around me, rocked to quiet my sobs. What's wrong with us? I asked. What can we do? Neither of us had an answer. They had the highest expectations when they got married, but apparently they were not investors. Investors. I'd like to talk today about marriage, and the title of this message is Investments Make Marriages Wonderful. Talk about investments in an economic sense. An investment is the purchase of goods and information that are not consumed today but are used in the future to create wealth. That is a definition of an investment. In finance, an investment is a monetary asset purchased with the idea that the asset will provide income in the future or be sold at a higher price, for profit. Invest pays high dividends later, and also can pay immediate dividends now. There are some very good statistics on marriage. For example, among people that are on the edge of divorce, in a number of counseling programs, it's estimated that a minimum of 30% of the people are able to step away from that. And if it hasn't gotten to that point, with a number of programs, there have been success rates of up to 90% that have redeemed people off of the cliff. Couples who get proactive and get counsel and attend seminars and read wonderful material on the subject of marriage tend to do better. And these are major investments. I know there are the other statistics. Half of marriages ended in divorce. And with multiple marriages, the divorce rate climbs dramatically. Half of marriages are plagued with affairs. 80% of teen marriages end in divorce. But that's not everybody. And that's not true with investors, especially with good information. And I find it interesting that some of the best books and some of the best experts, at least, are counseling with degrees that do resonate with people. A lot of them were on the brink of divorce themselves. And it was a wake-up call, and it helped them. At least some of them ended up turning to God and making some very, very important decisions and making some critical investments that changed the landscape. Can that happen for everybody? I don't know, but the potential it does exist. With some, maybe appropriate counseling would be of help. But the sky can be the limit with God's Spirit. However, most people don't understand that. They think that marriage was a natural union, that human beings just, you know, we ought to come up with this. Yeah, this makes really, really good sense. But it was God that created male and female. It was God that created the institution of marriage. Right after the Sabbath, right after establishing the earth with the recreation in Genesis 1, one of the earliest things he did was to give human beings the institution of marriage, because God himself is very, very family-oriented. In Jeremiah 10 and verse 23, though, we can understand how people can go into marriage thinking it's such a wonderful experience and have high hopes and high expectations, only to have those dashed by a jolt of reality in their case. Jeremiah 10 and verse 23, "O Lord," Jeremiah said, "I know that the way of man is not in himself." Is not in himself, not naturally, to walk and direct his own steps. And this is why the statistics are so skewed on the subject of marriage. I remember years ago in our former association that at Ambassador College made the proclamation, there has never been a divorce among the people here at Ambassador College. That was true up until about 1970. Probably, for all I know, it's true at ABC, where different students have been, that any marriages that have been engendered from that year of ABC has continued to be a success. Well, that can happen here. Let me cover a couple of the interesting adages about marriage that a number of people have put together. And I think that they are nuggets of gold. I think that they are investments that one can make. And so, certain adages about marriage. One being, a happy marriage is a union of two good forgivers. I think that carries a lot of weight. Marriage is oftentimes our best chance to grow up. The goal of marriage is not necessarily to expect to think exactly the same way, but to think together. The most important thing that a parent can do for his or her children is to love one's mate. treat your wife, I love this, treat your wife like a thoroughbred, and she won't turn into an old nag. To get full value out of joy, you must have someone to divide it with. There are any number of famous people that have had their own observations that they've given to marriage. One was Zig Ziglar. He wrote, "Many marriages would be a lot happier if the husband and the wife realized that they were on the same team, on the same side." That's right. Ben Franklin, "Keep your eyes wide open before marriage and half open afterwards." Oprah Winfrey, she wrote, "A lot of people in a relationship want to ride in the limo, but what you should want is that special someone who is willing to take the bus when the limo breaks down." Socrates made the statement, if you find a good wife, you will be happy. If you don't, you'll become a philosopher. Never get in love with anyone who treats you like an ordinary person. And I can remember when I was at Ambassador College, I know that there were some people that weren't yet married, and they were afraid that the kingdom of God would take them too soon, if you know what I mean. And it was like, yes, I know that we have to be careful, but don't you understand? I'm in a hurry. And well, I remember several students, they were graduating and they were pretty upset because they hadn't been dated enough, they felt, and they weren't getting married like a few of the people. Really, it was only a few that were engaged to get married. And they were commiserating and they were just having this terrible pity party. And it was just getting worse and worse. And I didn't know about it. I stumbled into it because we were all supposed to have a date for the ladies' night at the end of the year. And I asked somebody to come with me, and she says, yeah. And she says, I'm just a little bit cranky. And I thought, oh, great. And I thought, oh, it's going to be a long evening. And she says, yeah, I've got a speech, and you know what it's going to be about, don't you? And I says, no, I don't know. Well, you know, a lot of us are going to be leaving here, and we didn't get married off. Different words, but that was a message. And so she had been commiserating with her friends. They're all about 25, 26 years of age. And, you know, life ends after 25, right? No. So one of the girls said, yeah, not only that, yeah, we're just frustrated with the guys. It's the guys, their fault. And one said, the guys on this campus, they're a bunch of smiling chipmunks. That's what they are. They just, hi, and they don't date us. And they, you know, here we are. She asked me to evaluate her speech. She wanted to give it as a trial run. I wasn't going to do that. A lot of things I wish I could do over in life, but I wasn't going to. That was the right decision for her because that to evaluate the speech was to evaluate herself. And it was just too poignant, too personal. So she gave that speech to me, and I thought, wow, this is really heavy. And she gave it in the ladies' night, and the director was aghast. He stood up afterwards to evaluate, and instead of just talking about the different elements of the speech, he just wanted to make a general observation, and he said, kids, let's be careful. And we were older than kids. But he said, this is not your last chance to get married. It's not all over here. You know, you don't have to be in a hurry. And so he redeemed the evening, and I think people went away feeling better. But it's true, never get in love with anyone who treats you like an ordinary person or takes you for granted. That's not enough love for you. And so there are different adages that people have, from their own personal experiences, that they've accumulated and they've shared. And to implement some of the good points is to invest in one's own relationship. One thing to remember, over time, a woman's eyesight can become so keen that she can see right through her husband, even without looking at him. in a man's sight can be become so dull that he can look right through his wife and not even see her. That's why one of the scariest questions that some wives can ask their husbands is, "Honey, do you notice anything different about me today?" Oh, well, you didn't cut off most of your hair, did you? No. You're wearing a new dress. No, that one's 20 years old. You're in a good mood. No, and you're in the doghouse. It's dog beach for you. Good things happen to those who are observant. That's an investment in the marriage. And all these points and adages and observations are good, but we could say, well, what does the Bible say? Let me read a few, well, enumerate a number, not a few, quite a few Bible verses, and I don't want us to turn to these all, or we'll be here all day, so I'll just enumerate them, and we'll turn to some other passages in a few minutes. In Genesis 2, according to the New Living Translation, says, "The Lord God said, 'It is not good for a man to be alone. I will make a helper who is just right for him.' A man leaves his father and mother, and the two are united as one." Hebrews 13, verse 4, "Marriage is honorable in all." 1 Peter 3, verse 7, "Likewise, you husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor to the wife." And understanding that wives are very different than their husbands. God did not intend for males and females to think the same way and process information the same way. Husband may see a broad picture. The wives will see the detail. Is one better than the other? You need to have both. There are some details that if you omit could be critical. I can remember a history teacher telling us one time of the importance of a detail. He says, referring to the Civil War, "This is a spike." He's holding a nail that goes into a cobbler would take and drive into the hoof of a horse. "This is a spike that fell out of the horseshoe, that fell off of the hoof, that caused the horse to stumble, that caused the rider to fall, who happened to be the general that happened to lose the battle because he was on the ground, which ended up losing the war, which ended up losing the nation, all because of a spike that wasn't correctly linked into the horseshoe of the horse." Details matter. Men can see the broader picture at times, although there are exceptions. Men tend to see in concrete terms. Women are more relational, more subjective, more sensitive. You have to have all of this. It's as if God took all different qualities and traits and separated them. Men would get half and women would get half. One thing that women have that I wish I had more of is women's intuition. Sometimes I'll have that insight, especially if it's in an area where I'm quite familiar with the activity. But that's not across the board for sure. Women tend to pick up on things faster than their husbands. And it's a gift. It's a gift, I think. Anyway, the two are not the same. Men have more blood cells, are taller, have more 50% more brute physical force. And women are more fragile, more dainty, and yet they're durable and outlive men by 4 years. So there are definite differences. They're not all physiological. They're all mental. And the value of a great relationship is to incorporate the assets of both and to invest in both sides of the equation. Moving on, says Proverbs 5, verse 18, "Rejoice with the wife of your youth." When two people get married, what do they bring into the marriage? If they have repented and received God's Holy Spirit, or if they are led by God's Spirit to understand that there is a rhyme and reason to this way of life, then they're going to want to bring the fruits of the Spirit into the relationship, which include humility, includes the fruits love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness. There are 9 of them listed there in Galatians 5. And other aspects, maybe creativity, kindness, edification, compliments, a reasonable amount of idealism, a commitment to God. These are all investments. One story, a song that just drove me crazy when it came out, it was very popular. It was Barbra Streisand and Neil Diamond. And it was, "You Don't Buy Me Flowers." And just, Barbra Streisand sings, "You don't bring me flowers." And instead of saying, "Oh, I'm sorry," or "I could do better, I'll try to do that next week," he's got his wounds and he starts to lick them. "And you don't come to me and greet me at the end of the day." And she just totally ignores that. "You don't buy me flowers." And then he repeats what she's not doing. And then she keeps saying, "You don't buy me the flowers." And this goes on for 2 minutes. And people out in Radio Land are thinking, good music, you know, because they relate to it. Because, yeah, that's the way it is for us. And I want to, still, when I ever hear Neil Diamond's name, I want to say, "Here's $5. Go to Walmart. Buy her some flowers." You know, this, to end this circle of insanity where neither can pick up on the other person's needs. It's funny because people are so programmed, and not just by music, but by what they think is normal. When we were on our cruise for our 32nd anniversary, we were in this hall. It was 1,000 or 1,200 people in it. We had orientation. And the MC was saying, "Okay, now that we've explained about the boat and the different things you can do here, how many here are on their honeymoon? And, you know, married just this weekend?" And a bunch of hands go up. Everybody's applauding. And this is a paradox. They're all excited. Great, yeah. This man-made institution, they're thinking marriage is at its best at a time like this. So they're applauding. "Okay, how many have been married for 5 years? Oh, half the hands are up in the air. How many have been married for 10 years? A quarter of the hands are up in the air. How many have been married for 20 years? Well, not a whole lot of people. Polite applause. 25. Fewer. 30. There were just three couples. We were one of three couples to raise our hands. I didn't hear much applause. What I heard was, "Ooh, 30 years. Ah." Well, it was a prejudiced reaction by people that had different sets of values, that knew nothing about investment, that thought it was all about chemistry. Well, you want chemistry, but there's something missing in society. As popular as it is, what a paradox for them to be applauding like crazy for the ones that just got married, and then for those that have been married a little longer. They stopped at 30. They didn't get to, some of our people are 45, 50 years, which should be normal. Like, oh, well, of course. But not in society, not anymore. It's changing. It's very different out there. We have to return to the core values. We have to embrace investment. In Proverbs chapter 9, verse 1, I'll just quote that. "Wisdom has built her house." House can refer to a family. Proverbs 9, verse 9. "A wise man can gain more wisdom and be wiser still." And in chapter 10, verse 27, "And that man can have the respect of the Lord that prolongs days." And that means if he's married or she's married, prolongs days of marriage. Proverbs 11, 16. "A gracious woman retains honor, and a strong man retains wealth." You know, you got to worry if somebody says, "Yeah, I took a second mortgage out on our home, but don't ask me where the money went. By the way, I think I need another loan." Now that should send red flags. Chapter 11, verse 10. "When it goes well with the righteous, the city rejoices." Well, if a city were to rejoice, how much more a family? Proverbs 12, 4. "A virtuous woman is a crown to her husband." Chapter 15, 1 and 2. "A soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger." That can happen in any relationship, especially where people are taken for granted. "The tongue of the wise uses knowledge rightly." In chapter 15, verse 4, "A wholesome tongue," which is positive language, "is a tree of life." a tree of life. Yep. We can't undervalue that. It's so typical and it's so easy for people to say, well, everything isn't right with the relationship, therefore, I'm going to tell my mate the 10 things that he or she is doing wrong. One of our veteran ministers who did a lot of marriage counseling admitted that when he first started counseling, he said, I didn't realize that how ineffective I was by trying to solve everything all at once. He said, I would sit down, listen to the people, and it didn't matter if it went 2 hours, 3 hours, or whatever. When it was time to wrap it up, I said, we have we've gone over these things, and here are the 14 things you need to work on, you know, till we see each other again. 14 things. How discouraging could that be? Oh, man, I'm not doing anything right. Sometimes it's just one or two. And how did Christ do it? In Revelation 2 and 3, he always, when he evaluated the seven churches, he had positive things to say about all of them, and he wasn't lying. He didn't make it up. It's impossible for God to lie. But after saying things that were positive, like, we're for you, well, here's something that is not right, that could be changed, and here's how to do it, and we're behind you. And that can be encouraging. Maybe one or two points to guide and direct can make a big, big difference. It's an investment. Not what is said, but also how one is said. Something is said goes a long, long way. Utilizing these pieces of wisdom are investments that anybody can put into a relationship. One of the challenging things in marriage is in Proverbs 16, verse 2, it says, all the ways of man are clean in his own sight. I don't know if any of you have seen the movie from some time ago, Shawshank Redemption. Two prisoners are in jail in the penitentiary, and they're talking back and forth, and what are you in here for? The guy says, well, I'm innocent. And he says, that's amazing. People claim all these crimes have been committed. I haven't found anybody that's guilty yet in this place. Well, they're all in denial. But in a weird way, people can think, well, I'm pretty much down the middle. I mean, I'm not perfect, but I just don't make mistakes. You know, not big ones. And so it's a shock when a mate or some says, you are wrong. How it's said is as important as what is said. And there is a need for us to embrace humility because none of us are perfect. Let's turn over to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, and this is quite valuable, but so much is lost and ignored, not intentionally, but read over. Paul was inspired to write Ephesians 5 in order to show the relationship of Christ to his church. But also, there are wonderful, incredibly important aspects of marriage that are also touched upon. In Ephesians chapter 5, Ephesians 5 in verse 21 says, submitting yourselves one to another in fear of God. Let me start a verse before. Giving thanks always for all things unto God and the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. That would include the institution of marriage. Submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. So much of society would bristle at those statements and think that Paul was a male chauvinist and this is disgusting and we need rights. And if I had had some of the history that some of these people had, I'd probably feel the same way. Because there has been male chauvinism. There has been abuse. There has been the mistreatment of women in so many countries and so many societies. And so I can understand if somebody would wince over that. But let me ask you this series of questions. What if you were married to somebody that loved you to pieces? Somebody that would sacrifice for you. That if there was $1 left in the table, say this was yours, that would give and give and be there and protect, defend, would run into a burning building to save you, and would do anything for you, and sacrifice, and give more, and provide. If there was any way to do it, and just keep doing that, and be your servant, be your slave, just help you, and continue, would you care if he was head of the house?
Head of the house.
Wouldn't matter, would it? I find it even true in the church. I mean, with all the people that are all over the landscape, some think that we need a 12-man council, some maybe a 7-man. No, it's got to be 1-man rule or whatever. If the ministry loved the people, died for the people, sacrificed for the people, was there for the people, hustled, did what they could to be available, wherever, you think anybody care about if we're 1-man rule or 2-man rule or whatever? If love is in the equation, if love is the number one thing, if there are actions of love, if that's constantly shown time after time after time after time, people would be happy to say, you be the leader. Yeah, that's great. That's fine. Now, with being whoever is the leader in whatever it is, whether it's a congregation, a church, a family, even business or whatever, by biblical definition, that person is the greater servant. That person has to serve more, has to give. People have a very perverted view of authority that it's, whoever's at the top is top dog, and everybody down under the pyramid is got to, kowtow and hop to it. In a time of crisis, maybe a directive needs to be given, and maybe it's that the person who's the leader, and maybe it's because that person has a broader view of what's going on, what ought to happen. But the more responsibility, the higher the profile in the government of God, which includes family, the much more the leader has to be the servant, the giver, the initiator. And a lot of people are not ready to hear that. What? Well, I thought you just bossed people around. I thought, that's hypocrisy. Now let's go back to verse 21. It says, submitting yourselves one to another. There are times, then there are women that may excel, be far better than their husbands, to know how to do certain things. I've seen some women that had superior ability in handling money than their husbands. I've seen some husbands that do things better than their wives in certain areas. It seems to me that you, a smart couple, would want to access the talents of both. There are certain areas that I am definitely in subjection to my wife. One is in the kitchen, where I'm dangerous, unless I'm making oatmeal. Need to hang out with the Gennaro clan. Learn some serious skills, maybe. But no, I'm not that not that great. I can make a smoothie, that's true. But I'm limited. She's not. I would be nuts to think that I need to supersede her directives or her sense for what needs to happen in there. Now, when it comes to directions, hands down, there's no question. I know where I'm going. I should be the one that decides that. But there are some things, gardening. I know what a bag of black cow is now. But that's her domain. And she's happy with it. And why not? There are some things that it's better that I'm in subjection to her with. Other things, she in with me. Overall, I am responsible. If things aren't as good as they should be, I am directly responsible and accountable to God. And it's not fun being accountable to God if you don't do things correctly. And so it's not something, any responsibility in the family is not to be taken lightly. In verse 25, it says, husbands, love your wives. And I know that we understand that. But even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, I'm not sure that we have that sacrificial level, but we could. But I'll tell you what, if you do that, you are making an enormous investment. And those kind of investments pay, again, huge dividends. We sometimes are so just busy going through the motions. Yeah, we're married, we're doing this, we're doing that. And we don't realize maybe that these statements that are mentioned here in Ephesians are quite powerful. And they constitute the core of our marriage ceremony. When the minister says to the husband first, and to you, whatever your name, solemnly swear, and before all these witnesses and so forth, that you'll take so-and-so to be your lawfully wedded wife, in sickness and health. Oh, I don't know about sickness. Yeah. Health, yeah, we're lovey-dovey, yeah. Sickness and health. Or for better, for worse. Ooh, for worse? You mean if we had a business reversal? People are blinded by dopamine, I think. And then they say, whatever. No, before marriage. No mountain too high. No river too wide that we can't cross together. And they're not counting the cost. Maybe they've never had to sacrifice, never seen an example of that. Marriage is not for people that are unwilling to sacrifice. It's for investors. It's for givers. That's the difference. You know, in Ephesians, it says at the end of chapter 5, and it says in verse 31, and the two shall be made one flesh. This is a great mystery. It's a mystery to the people on that cruise that people could sacrifice and invest up to 40, 50 years and be together, 70 years in some cases. They don't understand that. They never heard it, never heard it explained, never. They think that if you don't get what you want out of it, then, you know, consider it a throwaway situation. We live in a throwaway society. And it's not that way. Not with God involved. So, male chauvinism has no place in a marriage. It should be drained out. And according to the definition, Matthew 20, verses 26 and 7. Matthew chapter 20, verse 26. But Jesus beheld them talking to his disciples that were arguing just after 3.5 years and just shortly before Christ himself would be crucified. They're arguing about who would be the greatest. How embarrassing. But Jesus beheld them and said to them with... Well, that's true too, but that's in chapter 19. That's 20. 20 in verse 26. But it shall not be so among you, as far as lording it over each other. But who would ever be great among you, let him be your servant or minister. Let him be the biggest giver. And whosoever shall be chief among you, let him be your servant. How society doesn't understand that. And in some cultures, it's very, very deeply embedded. And I'll never forget when we were in Latin America running into some of that. And we shocked the socks off this one woman. She was about 55 years of age. And I sat down with the people for one of their meals, and she screamed out loud. And I thought, what have I done wrong? And she said, he's eating with the people. Weird. But some of the people apparently knew that there was an echelon, and all the ministers sat over at that table, and nobody talked to them except the deacons. And this isn't everywhere, and I think we've gotten away from some of this now. But I'm talking about years and years ago, seeing some of that. And then people coming along thought, oh, well, that's the way to do it. No, that's not the way to do it. Let he that is chief among you be your servant, be your giver, be your servant, be your helper. And in a marriage, in any institution that God has that involves other people, that needs to be the prevailing attitude. There may be a time to scream, maybe when there's fire in the building. But aside from that, no. Now, another thing that is a big stumbling block, but you can change the investment in a marriage, is the understanding that the marriage is not a 50-50 proposition. It's a 100% proposition. There's something dangerous when you think, well, I'll go 50% and my mate's going to go 50%. We'll meet in the middle. And as long as we meet in the middle, everything's okay. What happens if one can't meet in the middle because one woke up late or is having an illness and can only go 48%? The carnal reaction is, oh, he or she's going only 48%. Therefore, I'll go 48%. Well, he thinks he's only going 48%, but he's really letting down. So I'm just going to embarrass him. I'm going to go only 40%. That's as far as I go. And then he reacts to that reaction. And then, you know, instead of a 50-50 relationship, over time it becomes maybe 30-30 or 25-25. It's impossible to operate that way if you reach 100%. Deuteronomy 16, verse 16, I think it is, that we read it during Holy Day offertories, talks about you give as you're able. Sometimes mates can give more in certain years than in other years. One happy woman I remember talking to out west was married well over 50, maybe 60 years. I said to her, "Was so wonderful that you're a nurse, you're able to help your husband because of his ailments." And she smiled and said, "That's right, I'm helping him. I'm just repaying him for all the things that he did for me in my crisis some 25 years prior to this." And so she says, "Just paying back, I'm just thankful." When there's 100% reach, then you don't run short. Kind of like the announcements we have for potlucks. Bring enough for your family and one more. And then we're never in deficit. That's good investment. Of course, in Ezekiel chapter 16, we see where Christ, or God, was married to the church, which was ancient Israel at the time, before it went waywardly. In Ezekiel chapter 16. Ezekiel 16, I'll read this from the NLT. Ezekiel 16 talks about God's relationship with ancient Israel. In verse 8, it says, "So I wrapped my cloak around you, declared my marriage vows. I made a covenant with you, said the Sovereign Lord, and you became mine. And then gave you different fragrant oils. Verse 10, I gave you expensive clothing, fine linen and silk, beautifully embroidered, and sandals made of fine goatskin leather. I gave you lovely jewelry, bracelets, beautiful necklace, a ring for you, earrings, a crown on your head." Verse 13, "And so you were adorned with gold and silver. Your clothes were made of fine linen and beautifully embroidered. You ate the finest foods, choice flour, honey, olive oil, and became more beautiful than ever. You looked like a queen, and so you were. And your fame soon spread throughout the world because of your beauty. And I dressed you in my splendor and perfected your beauty, says the Sovereign Lord." Quite an expression of love, where he wanted to give the very best to his wife. And he went all out. It's so important to appreciate the mind of God and how valuable it belongs in a marriage. In Hebrew, I might mention this before to some of you. In Hebrew, the word for man in Hebrew is ish. The woman is isha. So the word for woman in Hebrew is isha. And ish, it means the man. El is the word for God. So if you combine the three, ish and el and isha, that spells the word marriage. If you take the word ish and isha and put those together, it spells the word fire. It's important that God is in the relationship. And I don't know why any of us would not want that to be the case. So God is very passionate. He's giving. I sometimes see what looks like the vestiges sometimes of a 50-50 relationship, and sometimes people will marry or remarry and they kind of divvy things up. I pay the water and I pay the electricity bill, and you take care of your shoes and I'll take care of my toys, my fishing poles, my bait, my tackle, my guns, my car, and upgrade my golf clubs. But you're responsible for your own badger skins, your necklaces, your shoes. That works. I can understand something like that where he's, one says, I have promised and I felt for all these years I want a certain portion of my inheritance or the house or whatever to go to my son or my daughter or these people or whatever. That may be non-negotiable in a remarriage. But when you read Ezekiel 16, you just see this passionate, I want to give whatever I can, I want to enhance, I want to be there, I want to help. And that's wonderful. The most important thing is verbal reassurance or appreciation. Letting your mate know that you love her. Well, I told her that once. Of course, that was 6 years ago. People need more investment than that. People need to be genuinely told that they're appreciated. Love cups get empty very quickly. Just because of the wear and tear of life, they need to be refilled. It's like driving a car that gets 3 miles to the gallon. Pretty soon you got to fill it up again. Pretty soon it's time to invest yet again, both men and women in each other. In Malachi 2:14 is a statement that most people have read if they've been in the church any length of time. And it's chapter 2 and verse 14. I'll read it here. It says, you cry out, why doesn't the Lord accept my worship? I'll tell you why, says Malachi, because the Lord witnessed the vows you and your wife made when you were young, and yet you've been unfaithful. And so God has an issue with that. Well, lots of mistakes have been made by many people, and we can't do anything about the past, but we can do a lot about the future. Marriage is serious, and anyone unmarried can find strength and value in marriage. It's never too late. God states this as an indictment, but it's not like when that's the final answer. No, that's his statement, and then what human beings do in response is up to them. He's hoping that they'll have a relationship where God is in the middle of the relationship with Ish and Isha. In John chapter 2, it's quite interesting. The first miracle that God, that Christ made was not in a synagogue. It wasn't on the shoreline of Galilee. It wasn't in any building. It was at a wedding. In John chapter 2, first miracle recorded in Scripture that Christ performed is in a wedding at Cana. This was just north of the Nazareth of Galilee. In chapter 2, we read the following. And the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and Mary, the mother of Jesus, was there. Both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. It must have been put on by a wealthy family, because weddings were huge then, if they could be. They might last for a week. And here, not only Christ was invited, his mom and disciples. And so it was a festive occasion. And so there was typically a lot of food and quite a bit of wine. And the standard thing was to put out your best wine in the beginning before people's taste buds were sated, and then put out the less quality wine later. Verse 4, Mary said to her son, Jesus, they have no wine. And Jesus said to her, woman, why are you asking me this? His mother was confident and said to the servants, look, whatever he bids you to do, you do it. And there were 6 water pots of stone a lot of liquid and or capacity to store liquid. And verse 7, Christ said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." And they filled them to the brim. Some might have thought, oh boy, this is going to be a real downer. They've underestimated everything. We've got a huge crowd. There's no more wine and no more maybe food for that matter, less food if they've underestimated with the wine. And so they figured, well, I guess we're just going to drink water for the rest of the wedding. When the ruler of the feast tasted the water that was made into wine, didn't know where it came from, he goes to the governor of the feast, calls over the bridegroom. He says, look, normally we put out the best wine in the beginning, but in verse 10, toward the end, you've saved that which was the best for now. And that was a miracle. It was a miracle because Christ made it happen. And a wedding with this wedding without Christ involved would be substandard. But because of Christ's involvement, it was a crowning blessing to have all the wine that they needed. As when he had the 5 barley loaves and the 2 fishes incident, and Christ multiplied that food. Christ was involved. Otherwise, it would have been an ordinary meal and they wouldn't have been able to take care of everybody. So Christ has to be involved. It's interesting how that is illustrated here in John chapter 2, that Christ involved in it makes for a complete blessing. This is who we can depend on. This is who we're asking to be part of our marriage, if we're living up to the standards that the Bible has set forth. And we've promised to do that. We've made vows. I'm just going to quote Deuteronomy 23, verses 21 and 23, which says, "When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it would be a sin to you, and the Lord your God will surely require it of you. However, if you refrain from vowing, it would not be a sin in you. You shall be careful to perform what goes out from your lips, just as you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised." And when we're vowing, we're asking God to be in our relationships. And that's the biggest investment we can make. And I've already referred to our marriage ceremony. I understand that in our life, situations sometimes can be complicated. And as a result, sometimes before reconciliation, you need maybe counseling to weigh a lot of extenuating circumstances and options. But speaking in general terms, I think these are things that we all can appreciate. And you might say, well, why should I hear a message like this? I'm not married. You could be, very much so. Could be married yet again. And if not, be in a position to help your grandchildren, your parents, your sons, daughters, give them some additional insight and guidance as they go on to be married. Marriage is the opportunity for a husband to enable his wife to be the best person that she can be. You read in Proverbs 31 where the man makes that happen. You could talk about the extraordinary man that's behind the wife. And, of course, she can inspire him to be the best person that he can be. People respond to encouragement. They respond to compliments. They don't respond to negativism real well. Let me tell you where you're wrong. That doesn't go over very well. Nobody wants to be, and yet, of course, none of us are perfect, but there's a right way and a million wrong ways. And their timing has to be. One of the winningest football coaches is John Madden. Maybe he has the highest winning percentage of games coached. And he made the comment in his book, he says, sometimes as a coach you have to say the opposite of what you feel. When the team is winning game after game, everybody in the neighborhood is talking about how great we are and so forth. He said, then I have to get on the guys. Don't get complacent. Don't lose sight of the fundamentals. And then he says, when they lose a number of games and the whole world seems to be down on them, the talk shows and on radio and other fans, He says, I have to reach out and encourage them because that's what they need. Not more criticism where they implode. The ability to endure lots of criticism is limited with people, and they don't respond. And yet, in one psychology study they conducted at one university, they had what they call psychostatic sculptures, mannequins that you could move the arms and the legs and the neck around. And they had a mannequin on the stage, and they asked different women at different times, pretend that this is your husband. What is your relationship to him? And some would say, I see myself facing him eye to eye and shoulder to shoulder. We're looking at each other. For others, well, I see him over here and I'm way back here. And then the next question is, what would you do about it? And it was interesting. They had these mannequins. They led the people to believe that you could move the arms and the legs, but they had them actually frozen. And this one woman was asked, what would you do if you could change that marriage? And so she says, well, I'd go over to this mannequin. She tried to move the arms so that they'd reach out to her, and she's fighting with the statue. And it won't move and won't budge, and she's getting frustrated. She's starting to cry and was like, this is too much like the real life that it is. And it was gut-wrenching for her. People, the natural thing is if something's not right, it's the other person's fault. I forget who said that it's more important to, rather than finding the right person, is to strive to become the right person. And if you have two people doing that, wow. That can be absolutely marvelous. But even if one person, only one person in the relationship is serious about changing the status quo of it, sometimes that one person can do a great deal. There was a woman who was ready to get divorced from her husband. She was mad, but not just mad. She wanted revenge. Revenge. She went to one of her best friends and said, what do I do? What do you think? Because you've been through this, divorced. And the person says, I'll tell you what you do. Just deceive him with kindness. Just be really nice to him. Oh, I can't do that. I know you can't. I couldn't either. But trust me, this will probably be so effective. Just think about it. You deceive him. When he comes home, you tell him how much you love him. You tell him that he's just a wonderful person. And then you give him the best snacks, the best favorite thing that he has. And just keep doing that. Just do it for 1, 2, 3 months. And then when he's gotten used to that, then you make your dramatic announcement that you're pulling the plug and you're going to end it. And that's the ultimate revenge. Yeah, I like that. So she started to do that. And of course, he had his mind on himself. He was still out with the guys late at night. And nothing changed for a good while. But she was laying it on. Didn't know that she was investing in her relationship. After a while, he's thinking, home is my haven. You would think it was my castle. I really like eating my favorite foods and having this extended and so forth. And after a while, he thought, I ought to give her a present or something, And it's all this giving and giving. And he started complimenting her. He showed up earlier at the house. Soon later on, it was much more fun to be at home than it was to be out with the guys. And it just seemed to snowball. So when the 3 months were over, the friend said to the other woman, well, I guess pretty soon you're going to pull the plug. And she says, are you kidding? She says, he has become the person I always dreamed of. He's so kind, he's so helpful, and I let him know that. And it's just easier and easier to do that. And she was happily married. These people invested and invested and invested and didn't realize they made a difference. God and two people working at their best can make a real strong difference. it's something that makes the church stronger. When we have strong family units, we have strong marriages, we have a stronger church, we can do a greater work. What can go on externally is perhaps a function of what goes on internally with all of us. It all is about investments in reaping what we sow eventually. May not be right away. We see the dynamics change when we give to each other, and people respond, especially women will love to respond. Women never get tired of chivalry. They never get tired of that. And men sometimes think, well, we've achieved, you know, I've conquered her. You know, I've played games all my life. Now I had the challenge of getting married, and now that I've accomplished that, now it's moving on to other things. No, we take our mates with us. I would think that anybody that's considering marriage would want the other person to understand these principles, would want to know that the chances to have a very happy marriage would be, the odds would be enormously high that would happen. There's so much on this subject that I haven't touched on. There's just not enough time. I'd like to return to this subject soon. But let's strive to appreciate the fact that investments make marriage wonderful. Investments can turn things around, can give hope to people, and give encouragement, can inspire people to continue to win each other's company and to enable us to be the kind of happy people that God intends for us to be.